content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll finish the article we began last time titled The Forgotten Colony by Andrew Lawler. What excavations in Bermuda are revealing about one of Britain's first settlements in the Americas and the surprising ways it helped shape the New World. As many as 10 private dwellings would have made up the bulk of the town. So far, a scatter of other post holes suggests the remains of at least 3 to 4. In future digging seasons, Jarvis hopes to create a map of streets, lanes, and structures to flesh out the size and orientation of the settlement. Just to the west of a possible meeting house, excavators found a small piece of lead that once held panes of glass in place, at a time when such windows were reserved for the wealthy. This suggests a high-status individual, perhaps Governor Moore, and gives us a tantalizing hint of class differences among the houses, the archaeologist added. As we study each building, we expect to see a hierarchy of class emerge. All the soil exposed during the dig is screened nearby to recover small artifacts, and each day's finds are then sent across the harbor to the St. George's Lab for cataloging. Analysis of these helps researchers discern how early English colonists organized their new society. We want to know how Bermuda's first town both resembled and was different from the other English colonial prototypes, Jarvis said. So far, Moore's settlement appears to have been a unique hybrid of Jamestown and Plymouth. Like the former, it may have had a traditional Anglican-style church, yet, like the latter, it was constructed less like a military camp and more as a village with separate dwellings for families. In the decade after the Plough's arrival, English settlers flocked to Bermuda, including more ascetic Protestants hoping to create a perfect society on their island, Garden of Eden. Their example encouraged those with similar beliefs to view America as a haven for Puritan-minded people. By then, Bermuda was booming, with an English population outstripping that of either Virginia or New England. Tobacco had already been noted on the islands by sea venture castaway John Rolfe, famed for later marrying the Powhatan Princess Pocahontas at Jamestown. It was planted by an earlier Spanish castaway, and Rolfe used the Bermuda tobacco seeds in Virginia around 1612 or 1614, creating an export that saved Jamestown from financial disaster. Bermudians had a head start. The three kings had already made a great deal of tobacco, and one early settler predicted cultivating the crop would be very commodious both to the merchant and to the maker of it. White colonists first brought a single enslaved black laborer from the West Indies to Bermuda in 1616, 3 years before black people in bondage landed in Virginia. More followed. Those who had labored on West Indian tobacco plantations and were familiar with the crop were particularly prized. It was only in 1624 that Virginia's tobacco exports to England exceeded that of Bermuda. Eventually, tobacco's deleterious effects on the soil, as well as the limited land, ended the island's brief boom. Meanwhile, European ships brought rats that devoured food supplies and wreaked havoc on the ecosystem. Settlers wantonly killed flocks of cahow and other birds, while deforestation added to the swift economic decline. Colonists rapidly pivoted from farming to shipbuilding, trading, and privateering, and many of the enslaved laborers became sailors and stevedores. Fast and sturdy Bermudian ships soon crisscrossed the ocean, stimulating business in a vast arc from the West Indies to Newfoundland, while seizing enemy vessels as European powers fought to dominate the New World. Memory of the island's origins as kind of a paradise and then a tobacco powerhouse that briefly outshined their sister settlement in Virginia waned. A century later, when the colony joined the rebellion against Britain, Bermuda stayed within the empire, and today it is a self-governing British territory. Shakespeare concluded The Tempest by predicting that everything quote, shall dissolve, and like this insubstantial pageant faded, leave not a rack behind, end quote. Yet Jarvis and his team are recovering Bermuda's vanished story. In 2023, William Kelso visited Smith's Island to check on his protege's work. Archaeology is like a play, said the retired Jamestown excavator. The set is the landscape, and the script, the history, is usually all torn up and falling apart. Mike is pulling it all together and casting Bermuda in three dimensions. Next, we'll move on to an article titled Wild Flavors by Ellen Ruppelschell. For the young in Slovenia, creative chefs dish up. For the young, tiny nation, varied landscapes and rich history bring endless culinary inspiration. Every culture has a cuisine that tells its story. Slovenia, a Lilliputian nation about the size of New Jersey, but with less than a quarter of its population, has many stories to tell. Bordered by Italy, Austria, Hungary, and Croatia, the country has a landscape that varies dramatically. In the space of a few hours' drive, you can see a sweeping span of European scenery and architecture, from alpine lakes and medieval castles to Adriatic beaches lined with red roof villas and olive trees. The country's history is as diverse as its geography. Once part of a Slavic kingdom, Slovenia was later conquered by the Franks, and for 500 years it was ruled by the Habsburg family, all the while it endured foreign invasions, first the Ottoman Turks, and later the French, after Napoleon briefly conquered the territory. Throughout, Slovenes have retained their own language and ethnic identity, dating back more than 1,000 years. In 1991, Slovenia won independence from a fragmenting Yugoslavia and finally became its own nation. All these myriad influences led to a varied and sometimes surprising cuisine that I set out to explore this past spring. While hiking near the ski town of Granska Gora on the Austrian border, I gorged on platters of deep-fried and roasted pork with potatoes and sauerkraut, and for dessert on thick slices of apple strudel and Primorska Gibanica, a pastry stuffed with poppy seeds, walnuts, apples, and raisins. On the Adriatic, there is seafood risotto and grilled fish. Near the border with Hungary, goulash and other dishes are heavy with paprika. In the Alpine region, home cooks boil up pots of buckwheat and corn ziganci mush with sides of yogurt, cabbage, and fried eggs. The Primorska and Podravie regions produce vaunted wines. The latter in the northeast is home to Blauer Kölner, at more than 400 years of age, thought to be the oldest grapevine in the world. Together, these varied gastronomic traditions represent a recognizable culinary identity. Janez Bogatadzic, a Slovenian ethnologist, cookbook author, and food historian, told me by phone before my trip. Collaborating with the Slovenian government, Bogatadzic has identified 24 distinctive Slovenian gastronomic regions and 430 representative foods and drinks. Creative chefs have remixed these elements into prize-winning high concepts. As of 2024, 10 restaurants in the tiny country had earned Michelin stars, and 8 had Michelin Green Stars, a special award for sustainability. As Bogatadzic puts it, Slovenia's diverse local food traditions provide chefs an inexhaustible source of new modern ideas on plates. Ideas on plates is the perfect way to describe a meal at Hisa Franco, a faded country inn turned 3-star Michelin restaurant, run by the self-trained culinary savant Anna Ross. The restaurant is set in the Saka River Valley, and from the patio, I gazed out at the lowlands and hills. Streams, lakes, and forests spread out below. The villages had steepled churches and houses with steep gable roofs that finish in hip ends. It was hard to believe that this landscape had been home to some of the bloodiest battles of the 20th century, where 1.2 million soldiers perished in World War I. Now there was nothing but tranquility. The pastures were dotted with sheep, goats, and cows, whose milk is curdled into the region's famous Tolminik, an earthy cheese with a touch of sweetness Ros incorporates into some of her creations. Like many Slovenian chefs, she prides herself on the superlative quality of local ingredients. A third of the country is farmland, and more than half is covered with forest rich with mushrooms, wild herbs, asparagus, berries and other delicacies that Rose and her staff regularly forage. Not far from her back door, one can glimpse the silent Italian lagoon, Marano Lagunare, 37 miles to the south, where Rose sources her clams, squid, and sea urchins. Just off her patio, a tank of frisky rainbow trout pulses with water siphoned in from a nearby river. Rose, the daughter of a doctor, has an uncanny knack for spinning simple ingredients into inscrutable works of art. "I see flavors like a painter sees colors," she told me. "I taste with my brain, not my tongue." She was a teenager in 1991 when her country gained independence. Before that, she said, communist-era restrictions had confined the identity and individuality of the Slovenian people. With independence, anything was possible, including a career that seemed far from likely. "I never went to culinary school," she told me, "and that gave me a sort of freedom." Fluent in 5 languages, with a degree in international diplomacy from Italy's University of Trieste, Rose is an eloquent and stirring ambassador of Slovenia and its cuisine, but with a twist. "I like taking risks," she said. "I hate comfort zones. I find them killers of evolution. I rarely play it safe. It is flavors, not tradition, that define my kitchen. For me, flavor is everything." This approach brings frequent surprises. During a 15-course Fifty Shades of Red tasting menu, I ate my way through 3 renditions of pasta, including toasted barley risotto, risotta in Slovenian, cooked with wild asparagus and Slovenian truffles, a quote-unquote sandwich composed of a pair of nettle discs, one crisp, one salt, soft, filled with cream-fermented beans, prunes, and apricots, a potato baked in hay crust, yes, actual hay, served with roasted yeast-infused sour cream, and a single strawberry filled with creamed celeriac and horseradish. Both wine and juice pairings were on offer, the latter a procession of bewildering potions ranging from herb-infused barley and buckwheat water to a celeriac, plum, and lapsang tea. All told, this experience took roughly 3 hours. All this might sound a bit over the top, and frankly, it is. Rose has elevated Slovenian cuisine to a very high plane, but her insistence on remaining unfettered by tradition left me with an appetite for simpler, more classic fare, and to truly explore Slovenia's culinary heritage, I would have to look to other kitchens. 3 hours east of Hisa Franco, I came to a long-standing and revered establishment called Hisa Radua. The restaurant, which is also an inn, is situated in Luz, a charming village perched along the crystalline Savinja River. The day I arrived, the mountain backdrop was so breathtaking that it appeared to be photoshopped. The inn dates back to 1875, and the entrepreneur who purchased it in 1929 was the grandfather of Martina Breznik, the current executive chef and owner. Chic in an all-black ensemble accessorized with Harry Potter-style eyewear, Breznik was equal parts elegant. Through an interpreter, she confessed that she thinks about food 24/7 and even dreams about it. This was no exaggeration. During my 3-day stay, I rarely spotted her outside the inn's kitchen, dining room, or sprawling vegetable gardens. For while Rose cooks from the head, Breznik cooks from the heart. My cooking is what it is because of my grandmother and my mother, who both expressed themselves in this kitchen, she said. Those nostalgic dishes made by my ancestors are my foundation, though I approach them in a modern way. Home to 5 generations, Hisa Radua is very much a family affair. Philippe, Breznik's son, serves as both sommelier and waiter. Breznik's husband, Matyas, a reserved and soft-spoken man, is her sous chef. Christina, her daughter, is an architect and has collaborated on renovations of the restaurant and its accompanying guest house and outbuildings, some of which are remarkable. One guest room was carved out of a hay rack, a structure used for drying hay that is a hallmark of rural Slovenia. Another room was once a stable, and 2 others are tree houses on stilts. Those accommodations, though far from luxurious by American standards, have been carefully redesigned with features like hot tubs and terraces that overlook the rocky ridge that Breznik climbed as a girl. Breznik attended culinary school in Slovenia, but unlike many of her classmates, she did not study cooking techniques abroad. Rather, she remained determinedly Slovenian in her vision and approach. My cooking pays homage to the river and to the Alps that surround us, she said. She was an early adherent of the Italian-based slow food movement of the late 1980s, a global effort to promote sustainable agriculture while preserving traditional and regional cuisine. Since then, she's rubbed elbows with many well-known people in the food world, but she eschews celebrity. Trends are dishes that require explanation. I speak not with my voice, but through my food, she told me. Through taste, we identify as a nation and experience the land. Her most characteristic dishes are reimagined takes on Slovenian classics. She served me a soup of wild garlic, a salad of buckwheat, prosciutto, locally known as prosciut, and roasted radicchio. Local carp blackened with cuttlefish ink and scattered with fennel served with river trout. And chicken and leek cream on a porridge of Khorasan wheat, an ancient grain related to durum. For dessert, there was a slice of apple poppy seed roll, flanked with a spoonful of honey-sweetened ice cream anointed with an intense nutty oil squeezed from the seeds of pumpkins cultivated in the nation's northeastern regions. I'll admit that in a lifetime of eating, this meal stood out, not only for its culinary wizardry, but also for the variety and quality of the ingredients. As a child, Bresnik spent long afternoons in the mountains, foraging for mushrooms, berries, and herbs. When she and her friends lay flat on the riverbank to fish with their bare hands, she pulled so many trout from the water that her friends laughed at her duck-webbed fingers. Today, the fish at her restaurant comes mostly from the river, the mushrooms from the surrounding forest land, and the meat and dairy from nearby farms. Bresnik urged me to visit one of these farms. An alpine idyll, she said, was just a 20-minute drive away. I eagerly agreed, unaware that flooding earlier in the year had led to the closing of the mountain pass. After backtracking through what seemed like endless switchbacks, I arrived 3 hours late to find a peaceable kingdom of sheep, goats, and the odd donkey grazing like royalty on flower-strewn meadows framed by majestic peaks covered in dense forests of larch and spruce. At 3,800 feet above sea level, the grounds overlooked the renowned Matof Kot, a secluded glacial valley in the Kamnik-Savinja Alps. I knocked on the farmhouse door, and Janja Matk answered, surprised that I wasn't one of the clients she and her husband, Klemen, were hosting in their guest house that evening. She ushered me in, pointed to a seat near an enormous wood-burning stove, and offered tea. I declined. I was eager to return outside to that wondrous view. Janja understood. I feel so privileged to live here and see every day, she said. The property, which had been in the Matk family since the mid-15th century, has had a sometimes traumatic history. In World War II, the invading Germans sent the owners to labor camps and incinerated the farmstead. After the war ended, the family returned to rebuild. Janja is proud that the family farm is thriving, but she has no ambition to expand it. We have 5 boys and 53 goats, she told me, laughing. We don't want more because we don't want to grow beyond what we can handle as a family. We found Clement in the cheese house, an orderly, almost antiseptic building illuminated in harsh fluorescent lighting and lined with shelves. A man of few words, he proudly displayed 2 dozen or so perfect wheels, several of which soon would be on their way to Bresnik's kitchen. The farm also sells yarn spun from their own wool and is famous for its goat milk ice cream. My sample came flavored with rosemary and honey. Only one type of bee is allowed to be cultivated in Slovenia, the indigenous Carniolan honeybee, and beekeepers pride themselves on the flavor of the final product, which reflects the environment the bees inhabit. That honey had the tang of wild pine, befitting, I thought, of this deeply sylvan setting. Late that afternoon, Ljubljana, one of the smallest capital cities in Europe, I strolled the town's car-free center, stopping to buy a box of luscious strawberries at the legendary Central Market, and gawked at the majestic creations of Jože Plečnik, a Slovenian architect who also designed much of Vienna and Prague. One of his buildings, a 5-story secessionist structure, housed a restaurant called J.B. Restavarakia. The restaurant's founder, a vivacious sexagenarian named Janez Bratovos, is arguably Slovenia's most storied chef and his establishment is widely considered the country's oldest fine dining destination. Like Vros, Bratov's was a trailblazer. As a boy, he ate potatoes, bread, and meat if he could get it, and he knew nothing of haute cuisine. Left in the loving care of his grandmother, while his parents found work in Germany, he sought solace not in food, but in long-distance running. When I left school, I thought I'd get a job doing construction, he told me through an interpreter. But his grandmother had other ideas. She thought I should go to culinary school, he said. Her reasoning was simple. Chefs work inside where it's warm and dry, and they always have food. Bratovs got his first job at a tourist hotel, dishing out goulash, potatoes, pasta, sausages, and other local staples. Later, he moved to Austria, where his culinary views broadened, before returning to Slovenia to open a restaurant of his own in Domžale, a town not far from Ljubljana. With two hungry children and too few customers to feed, the next 6 years were difficult for Bratovs. Then one day he got a call. The Slovenian Prime Minister, Janez Drnovšek, was coming for lunch. Drnovšek, a vegetarian, ordered a simple pasta dish rather than one of the restaurant's more elaborate offerings. Bratovs's menu currently includes such preparations as ravioli with pistachios, goat curd, and foie gras. Still, the Prime Minister was impressed and became a regular. Others followed suit, and in 2001, Bratovs moved his restaurant to the capital, where today it lures patrons from around the globe. As is typical in this small country, Bratovs intertwines his business with his personal life. His wife, Emma, runs the place. His son, Tomas, is a fellow chef who works with him in the kitchen. And his daughter, Nina, is a sommelier who oversees the wine list as well as customer service. The Bratovses purchase their saltwater fish and shellfish from a single boat, manned by a family of fishers whose nets are designed to allow small fish to escape unscathed. The olive oil comes from a family of growers in nearby Istria, and the salt is harvested by a family of farmers in the coastal Slovenian city of Piran, where production methods have barely changed for 700 years. It's very difficult to eat badly in Slovenia because we can grow or forage the best raw ingredients, Tomas told me over a glass of regional sparkling wine. Like Ros, the Bratovses source freshwater trout from the Soka River, including the rare marble trout indigenous to the region. During World War I, hungry soldiers lobbed grenades into the river and skimmed off the dead fish. The species were further diluted when fishermen, hoping to boost the river's overall fish population, introduced brown trout, creating a hybrid species. In the mid-1990s, a research institute called Tour de Valat strove to resuscitate marble trout, and over the next few decades, genetically pure marble trout were once again found in the headwaters of the Soka River. The Tolman Angling Club, a conservation society that has hatched and raised marble trout since 1989, opened a new fish farm in 2015, not far from Hisa Franco. Bratovs told me that, perhaps counterintuitively, almost any animal species is more likely to survive if it is a sought-after delicacy. This is true not only of marble trout, but also of venison, wild boar, and even bear, all of which appear on his menu. Animals don't need help in Slovenia because we cherish them, he told me. Every animal here has a fantastic life. Vegetarians may not agree, but the livestock I observed grazing the fields and meadows of Slovenia did appear to lead lives nearly as blissfully as those humans who feast on them. Slovenia's high-end restaurants have brought hordes of foreign visitors to even the most far-flung regions of the country, but in my time there, I saw few locals seated at their table, which seemed priced for the jet-setting crowd. Still, there were plenty of other lower-budget options that reflected the nation's rich culture and history. On my final day in the country, I stopped at a cluster of homes that passed for a village. There were no fancy restaurants here, even cafes. Only a single stand selling burek, a traditional Turkish phyllo dough pastry stuffed with meat, cheese, or spinach. Tantalized, I stood in line behind a bevy of men in work clothes, whom I later joined outside an upturned barrel doubling as a table. Cheap and filling, burek was long considered déclassé by Slovenian's moneyed set, and few self-respecting Slovenian super chefs would include it on their menu. For some reason, knowing that made my lunch all the tastier. We'll move on to an article in Prologue titled Poetry in Promotion by Luke Savage. How the dubious tradition of song sharking led to a strangely beautiful repository of folk art. As popular music grew in mass industry in the early 20th century, a murky assortment of companies popped up and began to practice that came to be known as song sharking. Advertisements enjoined ordinary Americans to send in their original poems and lyrics, at which the company would set the music to a rather large fee, a few hundred dollars depending on the year. Early song sharking companies in the 1910s merely set customers' lyrics to sheet music and mailed the sheaves to the customer as a collector's item. In later decades, sharking companies enlisted whole teams of session musicians to give people submissions the full-blown studio treatment and put them on records. And while many Americans were no doubt satisfied with the novelty of hearing someone on the gramophone singing their lyrics, many song shark advertisements dangled in further enticement. The music business might just be a cashier's check and a postage stamp away. The advertisements, typically nestled inside popular magazines and supermarket tabloids, tended to address readers with the smarmy cadence of a door-to-door salesman, hinting at the possibility of a big payday. Mail your song poem on love, peace, victory, or any other subject to us today, announces an emblematic example from a 1922 issue of Illustrated World. We revise song poems, compose music for them, and guarantee to secure publication on a royalty basis by a New York music publisher. Of course, most of these song poems had no life beyond the LPs that companies mailed to paying customers. Of the estimated 200,000 songs that companies produced from the lyrics of would-be folk lyricists between 1900 and the early 2000s, when the practice petered out, no one ever became a hit. Still, the enterprise struck at a deeply rooted American desire to win fame and fortune instantly, based on one's own exquisite originality. As poetry, the lyrics could run the gamut from generic and derivative to just plain weird. But buoyed by the musicianship of studio professionals, and sharpened by the formal conventions of popular songwriting, the effect could be earnest, whimsical, even charming, and plenty of paying customers seemed to have been quite happy with the results. In the 1990s, song poems thus acquired a cult following among Americana collectors and now enjoy a second life thanks to various compilations, perhaps most notably the 2003 CD, The American Song Poem Anthology, a testament to their status as an unfiltered, radically democratic form of outsider art. I love pop music, Phil Milstein, who produced that album, remarked in an NPR interview shortly after its release. But I'm aware that for great pop songwriters, there's always some meditation on life experience and the craft of the finished work. With song poem music, there is no such meditation. It's much purer expression of human thought. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading from the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.